Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
Well, good morning. We want to welcome everyone here today, every single person. We have all of so many of our members here. We're always glad to see all of our brothers and sisters who are part of this local body. We don't ever want to take one another for granted, so it's always a pleasure and a wonderful benefit to be together and to see each other. We also always have visitors here, and we're delighted that you're here. We thank you for coming, and we want to be a help to you, and we hope that the service that you're participating in this morning as we come before our God and worship and praise and now receive from Him a message from His Word that you'll be built up and strengthened and encouraged. We're in the middle of a lengthy series here at Lost River that focuses on how people encountered Jesus and as a result their lives and their character were transformed and changed. But this morning we're going to take one break from that series in order to address something that I think will be beneficial to some of us who may be stressing and fearful and worried about the coronavirus. And I know that there's more scientific ways of describing that, but that's what I'm going with. I know it's on a lot of people's minds, and now that there's been confirmed case here in Kentucky, it's something that people are worried about and thinking about. And so we're going to talk about a topic this morning that I think will be helpful to you as you wrestle with that, or be helpful to other people that you can share this information with. In addition to what I'm going to speak about this morning, there are some notes printed on the back of the handout that's a little bit different than what I'm talking about, but that also addresses this issue, so you can have that for supplemental information. Then tonight's discussion groups will give an opportunity for people to get together and talk about this in an environment that hopefully can encourage and build us up. So I want to begin this morning by saying that some of Jesus' most difficult commands were not the things that he said to do, although there's a number of those that I find very challenging. But the most difficult commands that Jesus gave, I think, are the ones that he said not to do. There's a number of things Jesus told you and he told me and he told his disciples, don't do this, that are very difficult. In fact, we could go so far, if we're honest, as to say they're kind of unreasonable. And they sort of seem impractical. In fact, someone could even say impossible to do. Unless Jesus died for our sins and rose again and was seen. Impossible to do that make no sense are highly impractical unless and only if He actually died for our sins and was buried and rose again and was seen. And if that happened, then all of a sudden they take on a whole different light. In fact, his disciples struggled very much. And you may, if you're familiar with the gospel stories at all, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll remember that the disciples are constantly being told by Jesus to do some things and not to do some things. And they keep doing the things they're not supposed to do. And they keep doing the things that they're not supposed to do. I think I said that right. They keep doing things they shouldn't do, and they do things that they are not supposed to do. I think I keep saying that wrong. Jesus said, don't do it, and they did it anyway, and they did it anyway over and over again. And it was like that until they saw him alive after he had been crucified, heard him alive after he had suffered, and they touched him in the very places where fatal torments and fatal wounds had been inflicted on his body. And after that, these things that Jesus told them not to do suddenly seemed like, I think I can not do that now. And one of the things that I'm talking about this morning has to do with this. Jesus said, and he didn't use this word phrase exactly, but you get the idea. He said, thou shalt not fear, to use Old Testament King James language. Jesus told the disciples, thou shalt not fear. In fact, he put it more like this, fear not. Some translations put it. And he said it over and over again. He would tell the disciples, fear not. And then you know what they would do? They would be afraid. And he would say, fear not. And then they would be afraid. And he would say, fear not. And they would be afraid. And they did that over and over again. And he would tell them, don't be afraid. Maybe the plainest way for us in our common vernacular to put it. And yet, in spite of his telling them, don't be afraid, they would often be afraid. And I'll tell you, I get that. I think if you and I were there with Jesus in those situations, we would have been just like them. We would be no different. Because unless Jesus died and rose again, it just kind of makes no sense not to be afraid. Because there's a lot of things out there to be afraid of. I remember years and years ago, Janice and I were first married, and I had said to my older brother, 5 years older than me, when he got married to a woman who had never been skiing, that I would never make that mistake. There was no way, because I loved to ski. Skiing was like everything to me when I was a teenager growing up. And I was like, there's no way I would even date someone who doesn't know how to ski. And then I married a woman who had never been on skis before. But as soon as it was possible, we got her on some skis. I got her up there. And of course, hey, this is easy. I've been doing this my whole life. No problem. So we rent her some skis, get her suited up, and straight onto the chairlift. And up we go. And then as we get to the place where she's going to disembark, I begin to notice there's a panic in her eyes. And I tell her, hey, I've done this before. I've done this 1,000 times. It's easy. I'm not afraid. Don't be scared. Don't be afraid. And it didn't matter how much I said, thou shalt not fear, Janice. I'm your husband. Fear not. Don't be afraid. None of it was going to work. She was going to be very, very afraid. Didn't matter that she was only going 2 miles an hour on a 1% grade on soft snow. She was terrified. And it's kind of like the disciples when Jesus comes to them in Matthew chapter 10 and in verse 16. And he says to them, he's about to send them out. This is the 12, and he's about to send them out for a little preaching trip. And he says to them, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Now think about that for a moment. Obviously, this is a metaphorical statement. His disciples weren't literally sheep. So I can't say literally he's sending out his disciples as sheep among wolves. But metaphorically, he is doing this. And that's not a pretty picture, is it? Have you ever seen what happens to a sheep when it's abandoned to the wolves? There's nothing but hooves and teeth left when the job is over. And Jesus says, I'm sending you out, and I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves. And therefore, he says, they say, oh, that sounds scary, so what should we do? And so Jesus says to them in verse 26, so don't be afraid of them. You're sheep, and you're going out among wolves, so don't be afraid. Fear not. Thou shalt not fear as you go out as sheep among wolves. I can sort of see the disciples looking at that and saying, okay, so you want us to go into a terrifying and dangerous and threatening situation and not be afraid. Is that what you're saying, Jesus? And he says, yeah, that's exactly right. And in verse 28, he says, in fact, do not be afraid of those who will kill the body. Okay, before, you were talking about they might haul us before tribunals, they might lie about us under oath, and they might even imprison us, but now you're talking about the worst that man can do? As sheep among wolves, they might kill us? Yeah. But don't be afraid of them. Don't be afraid of the ones who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. You see, the Lord has allowed us in our human freedom the ability to experience things that are quite frightful and even do things to one another that are beyond horrible. But God has placed a very definite limit on the extent of damage and evil that one person can inflict upon another. The amount of suffering that one person can inflict upon another. And so when mankind does his maximum worst and kills you, they have then put you beyond their ability to do you any more harm. And so Jesus says, I don't want you to be afraid of them. And instead, I want you rather to be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. So there's a greater fear that if you'll get in tune with, and if you'll recognize a power that is greater than man's power, it will deliver you from the fear of man and the fear of what anything in all of creation can do to you. Because you see, as long as you think of the ultimate thing that you can suffer as being what man can do to you, then you become a slave to man. You'll do whatever they tell you to in order to preserve your life and well-being a little bit longer. And we are easily co-opted into doing evil by evil people when they hold over us the threat of death. But Jesus says you don't need to be co-opted into their evil ways. You stay righteous. You keep doing what's right. You keep doing what God's will is, because there's a limit to what they can do. And so don't be co-opted by their evil. You remain true to the God of heaven and recognize His superior power and that He has control not only over the body but over one's eternal soul. So He then gives them a little bit more encouragement. He says to them something that sounds like He's all of a sudden talking about something different, but it's not. This is just a little bit more encouragement. He says, "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside of your Father's care." I didn't know, you may have known that, I didn't know that two sparrows were sold for the price of a penny, but apparently they're going pretty cheap these days, so it might be a good time to get in to sparrows. But he says the point is they're relatively worthless. They're a dime a dozen or something like that. So, you know, but yet not a single one of them falls to the ground without your Father's care. Now, it doesn't say that they never fall to the ground. He says, but when they fall to the ground, it's not because they somehow got outside of the realm of God's control, or that He fumbled the ball, or that He took His eye off of the ball for a minute and you fell and slipped through the cracks. No, God is mindful of everything and everyone and every situation that's going on, all the way down to the sparrows themselves, and they're under your Father's care. So as it relates to you and me, and He says this to His disciples who are about to go out as sheep among the wolves, even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. See, God values you, is what He's telling them. God's watching you. He's aware of the situation. He is in control of everything that's going on around you. And you're much more valuable to Him than all the sparrows of the world. He's got this. He knows who you are by name and even the number of hairs on your head, which I know is easier for Him to do for some of us than for others, Travis. But he's got it under control. Every one of us, from Travis to Quentin, He knows every number of hairs on your head. And so Jesus says, because of that, don't be afraid. Not because there's nothing to be afraid of, but because God, who should be our greatest fear, our greatest awe, our greatest respect, knows what's going on, and He's got you, and He'll be with you. And even if you fall to the ground like the sparrow, it's not because you've slipped through the crack. Now, this, I think, made a little bit of sense to them that it might not make to us because of something that had happened with them two chapters earlier. And I want to step back into Matthew chapter 8 now to show you what experience they had been to that might have helped them be a little bit more prepared to not be afraid as they went out as sheep among wolves, recognizing the threat and danger of their very lives was at stake. But they had experienced something that might have set them up for these words that Jesus had spoken to them about not being afraid make a little bit more sense. And it's a pretty famous story from Matthew chapter 8, beginning in verse 23. It tells us that Jesus got into the boat and His disciples followed Him, because that's what disciples do. So they all get into the boat, and suddenly as they're out on the Sea of Galilee, it's a very large lake and there's mountains around it, and it's notorious for sudden windstorms swooping down into the lake and stirring up huge waves. And it was not uncommon at all for the small vessels that they went out in on that lake for them to be swamped and sink in the Sea of Galilee. So as they're out there, all of a sudden, very quickly, a furious storm, not just any storm, not a bad storm, but a furious storm came upon the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. But then famously, Jesus was sleeping. Mark adds that he was asleep on a mat in the stern of the boat. So all of a sudden, this terrible storm, the water's coming into the boat, and Jesus is in the back of the boat on a mat, sound asleep. And I've often wondered, was he really sleeping, or is he doing like, you know, you do with your kids sometimes? You're laying there wondering what they're going to do and watching what they're going to do, and you're pretending to be asleep. But it says they woke him up, so I'm assuming he was actually asleep on the boat. And when all this happens, the disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we are going to drown." This isn't going well. This is a furious storm, and we're experienced boatsmen and fishermen. We know this lake, and we know how much this boat can take, and we're going down in the storm. And so he said to them, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" Then he got up, and he rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. So Jesus asks them a question. Why are you so afraid? To which, if I had been one of the disciples in the boat and not trying to be a smart aleck at all, I would have said, "Well, Jesus, it's because, you see, there's a furious wind. We're in a small fishing boat. And when furious storms come on the Sea of Galilee and you're caught in the middle of the lake on a little boat, the boats go down and we're going to drown in the water. And afraid is what you do when that happens." And so then Jesus does something. He rebukes this storm. With the words of his mouth, he makes it a placid calm. And now what happens next is recorded by Matthew, but I want to look at Mark's recording especially, which was probably influenced by Peter. Peter's probably the one dictating these words to Mark, who was there in the boat. And here's how he describes it. It says, "Then they feared exceedingly." I love that, because before, when the storm was raging and Jesus was sleeping and they thought they were sinking, they were terrified, they were afraid. But now that Jesus has calmed the storm and it's a perfect peace, they are exceedingly afraid, exceedingly terrified. In fact, the wording that Mark uses is kind of odd. He puts together, like a noun and a verb form of fear and combines them together. So with fear, they were afraid. It was just fear abounding. They were terrified exceedingly, not any longer because of what was going on in the storm around them, but because of who was in the boat with them. Because now they had experienced something they had never experienced before. They'd seen terrible storms. They'd heard reports of people drowning. They maybe had thought that they were going to go down before. But now they're standing in the very presence, in the same boat, with someone that they don't have a category for. He is an unknown quantity and quality as far as they are concerned. And they ask one another, "Who can this be? Who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" What's more terrifying than sinking into a watery grave? Not much. I mean, seriously, if you want to think about what's more terrifying than sinking down into the depths of the sea? Just something that is beyond your ability to reckon with. And they are beginning to come face to face with someone that they have no way to get a handle on. And they're exceedingly afraid. Fear him who has a power beyond what you can ordinarily experience. People can do their worst. They can kill you. Things terrible can happen to you. But maybe there is a power that is far greater than that, that deserves your reverence, that deserves your awe, that deserves your fear, and you should honor and obey him. And maybe in the doing of that, all of the other fears that ordinarily unsettle you sort of become a calm in his presence. I think it's interesting to focus on the fact that in all of this, Jesus is not telling them, "Don't be scared. there's nothing to be afraid of. You ever hear anybody say that to you? Don't be scared. There's nothing to be afraid of. My mom, she's the author of this famous statement. I don't know how many times as kids growing up, she would tell us, now kids, don't be scared. There's nothing to be afraid of. The only problem is, you know, my mom wasn't quite as truthful as Jesus, because Jesus isn't saying that. Jesus is saying you don't have to be afraid even when there's something to be afraid of. And, you know, really, even as parents, it doesn't do us any good to just go around telling our kids, hey, there's nothing to be afraid of, and then just trying to create a world that's so safe that they never encounter any sort of threatening situations. As someone else has pointed out, it's much better to make them strong than safe, because you can't defend them against every potential threat, but you can make them strong enough to be able to deal with it. And that's what Jesus is doing. He's not saying, don't be scared. There's nothing to be afraid of. He's saying, even when there's something to be afraid of. And I'm not painting, whitewashing this. Jesus says, you're going out like sheep among wolves. And they're going to lie about you. They're going to say terrible things about you. They're going to prosecute you in courts. They're going to haul you before tribunals. They're going to imprison you. And in some instances, they may even kill you. But don't be afraid, because I have something to give you. And if you'll learn to fear me and trust me and do what's right when all the world's trying to get you to do what's wrong, you won't have anything ultimately to be afraid, because underneath it all are the everlasting arms. Now, here's what I want us to understand, and this is our transition point in the sermon, so stay with me. The disciples, in spite of the fact that they were in the boat and that this wasn't the only occasion that they encountered Jesus doing something just absolutely remarkable, and in spite of the fact that Jesus told them over and over and over again, do not be afraid, they didn't get the lesson very well. They, in fact, sort of experienced an epic failure. When it came down to the end of Jesus' life and he was arrested and tried and condemned, drawn before men and condemned who lied about him, brought him before tribunals, convicted him, and killed him, the disciples feared greatly. They did not get this lesson. And we could put it this way. When Jesus died, they lied, they denied, and they hide. I know the verb tense doesn't work, in fear. But that's the only way you can get it to work, right? They lied, they denied, and they hide in fear when Jesus is arrested. Even though he had told them over and over and over again, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of them who can do these things to you in this life only, but their power does not extend beyond, but fear him who has power over body and soul. Don't fear them who can destroy the body, and they went all in fear of those who can destroy the body. Don't fear them, but fear him. And they said, we'll deal with him, because that's later and they're now, and that's what's frightening us. And so they hid in fear when Jesus died. It was an epic failure. But then, a few days later, they emerged from hiding and finally began to do what Jesus had been telling them to do all along. And they became fearless. And they went out, and you know the story, and it's the only reason, it's really the only explanation for how you and I are here today. They went out on the streets of Jerusalem where Jesus had been tried, flogged, crucified, and they stood up among a crowd of people who had just crucified Jesus and said, you've killed the Messiah. He was God's anointed. He was the one that we had been looking for. There was ample evidence for this. There's no excusing yourself. You've crucified the Son of God, the Messiah, the hope of Israel. And we can attest to that because we have seen him risen from the dead. You killed him. God raised him. We have saw him, and you need to repent. You need to turn. You need to change your heart toward him and align your lives with God. And some of the people believed, and some of the higher-ups and officials and who had the most to lose rejected, and over time began to persecute those apostles. who continued in the face of the greatest persecutions and obstacles imaginable to stay with their story. No, Jesus is risen, and we have seen him. We have heard him. We have eaten with him. We have touched him. He is risen from the dead. So, what was it that changed these disciples? It wasn't another lecture that Jesus gave them. It wasn't another sermon. It wasn't another ride in the boat in choppy waters. It wasn't witnessing another healing. It was seeing, hearing, and touching Jesus alive after he had overcome the worst that men can do to you. It was realizing that their ultimate fear had been defeated. Think about that. What was the one thing that could make Jesus' command, "Do not be afraid, fear not, thou shalt not fear"? What's the one thing that can make that thing make sense? It is when the thing that you fear the most has been disarmed. The Hebrew writer puts it this way: we as human beings are subject to death, so the Son of God became subject to death. He shared in our humanity so that through his death and resurrection, he might release from the fear of death all those who for all their lifetimes had been subject to that fear. And in doing so, Jesus defeated Satan, who uses that fear to control us, to hold us to do his will and to live out our lives in abject fear of him and fear of death and fear of man and what's going to happen to me. And Jesus came and entered our situation and faced the very worst that we could possibly imagine facing. And he faced it, and he faced it down. He defeated it. He triumphed over it in the cross, and he's risen again. And in the light of that, our fears begin to diminish. And so, we can fear not. What was an unreasonable and impossible not commandment that Jesus had given was unreasonable and unfulfillable, undoable, until it wasn't. Until it became actually a way of life. For the apostles and for those who heard their testimony spoke with such courage and fearlessness in the face of threats and persecution, that the church began to spread and to grow. Until, in fact, over the course of a few centuries, it overtook the pagan empire of Rome itself. In fact, we have a document written during the time of Marcus Aurelius, who's perhaps famous to most of us because of his appearance in that movie, The Gladiator. He was the one who was killed by Commodus. So he was this philosopher, emperor, but he was a reasonable guy on the most part, but he persecuted Christians. It was the fourth major persecution of the church, and it was in around 160, as I recall, A.D., and as these Christians were being persecuted, one of the interesting things that happened was that there were medical professionals who were, by law, forbidden from doing autopsies. They couldn't examine dead bodies. As soon as a body died, it had to be burned or buried and disposed of. They couldn't do research on the deceased. But what they could do is research on those who were dying. And so there is a lot of documentation from a historical doctor of sorts by the name of Claudius Galenus. And he mentions Christians about four or five times in his writings. And in one place, he said this about the Christians who had been sent into places like the Colosseum for the games, where they had been torn by lions and faced other forms of persecution. And when he examined them at the point of their death, this is what he mentions. He says, "For fearlessness of death," referring to Christians, he says, "for," and he was not one, but he says about them, "for fearlessness of death and the hereafter is something we witness in them every day." So here, around 160 AD, is a person who is seeing the effects of the resurrected Jesus still at work in the lives of his followers. And he says there was something different about these Christians. Every day we witnessed a fearlessness of death and of what lies beyond death in them. And we saw it time and time and time again. The historian Rodney Stark, who wrote a book entitled The Rise of Christianity, says it was the reaction of Christians to the plagues in the second and third century which was key to the explosive growth of Christianity in the Roman Empire. Because when these horrific plagues spread through the empire, and a couple of them were apparently just devastating, all of the unbelieving Roman people just drew back in horrible fear. And the Christians became brave and cared for the sick, provided funerals for the dead, and did all kinds of things that demonstrated exactly what Claudius Galenus witnessed in up-close and personal situations, a fearlessness of death and of the hereafter. You know, when I took Janice skiing those many years ago, I wasn't afraid when we got off the chairlift and started down that slope. Because I had been skiing all my life. There's two reasons. I'd been doing this all my life. I'd been there before. I'd done that. And I'd been on that slope before. And I was in control and I wasn't afraid. And I know it just didn't make sense for me to tell her, you know, don't be afraid. But I wasn't afraid. For me, it was just simply I'd been there and done that, right? Been there, done that. This is nothing. You know, there's a reason that Jesus can look down through the corridors of history and speak first to Peter and James and John and the others and say, hey, there's a lot of danger out there. And there's some pretty frightening things that can happen to you. But don't be afraid. Fear not. Don't be afraid, because I've been there. And I've done that. You see, you need not fear what I have conquered. You need not fear what I have conquered. I love that. In fact, what I'd like for us to do as we wrap up this morning, I've got one more verse I want to show you. But before we put it on the screen and then we sing together, a hymn of invitation to anyone who's decided it's time to align their life and their purposes with God's instead of their own, so that they don't have to live in fear of death or disease or any other such thing, but can have this fearless confidence as a result of our union with Jesus Christ. That opportunity is shortly to be yours. But before we do all of that, I'd like for just all of us, because I think we need to do this, and I want everyone to participate in this. Instead of saying what Jesus would say to us, you need not fear what I have conquered, let's just say it, I will not fear what he has conquered. I want you to think about what that means. Jesus has come in the flesh. God has come in the flesh to take on our weakness, our limitations, to be confronted with our terrors, and to face them and to overcome them, including death and the grave and the worst that men can do itself. He said, in this world, you'll have trouble. But take heart. I have overcome the world. So what I want us to do is just say together a couple of times. Say together, I need not fear what he has conquered. Let's say that together. I will not fear what he has conquered. I will not fear what he has conquered. And so, you know, when we think about this coronavirus or any other thing that comes along in the future or in the present that we find unsettling or concerning, a few things that I think we ought to take away and consider is, number one, we ought to take reasonable precautions. None of this is to say that we shouldn't take reasonable precautions. And so we want to do that. In fact, the elders are talking about what reasonable precautions may look like going forward, depending on how the situation develops for us as a congregation in our gathered activity. So it's perfectly fine to do that. In fact, I think there's plenty of biblical warrant that we should take reasonable precautions. But we should not fear as the world fears. If you don't believe that there's a God and that you just cease to exist upon death, or if you believe because of a consciousness of guilt in your life that you're going to be punished by God's wrath upon your death, then it makes sense that you would be absolutely terrified and be willing to do anything and hurt anyone in order to preserve yourself for a little bit longer in this world. Don't ever, as a follower of Jesus Christ, think that way. I do not need to fear anything that He has conquered. And so we may have emotions, we may have reactions, but we're not going to live in fear the way the unbelievers would fear. And then finally, we can look for opportunities to serve. Just like those early saints and plagues that swept through Rome, look for opportunities to take advantage of this, to serve, to help, not shrink back, but to demonstrate courage and faith and perseverance and, most importantly, love for those who are suffering and hurting and who are in the grip of fear. So while we would never ask for things like this to come upon us, upon the world, upon our nation, we certainly want to ask the question, how can God be glorified in this? And how can the love of Christ be manifest in me and through me while the world around me falls into panic? And so I want to conclude with this. In the book of Revelation, when the early saints were facing this horrible persecution, John had a vision of the resurrected and glorified Jesus. And that's why it's called the Revelation. It is the unveiling and the revelation of Jesus as He now is. And when John saw Him, he was so glorious that words fail to describe, even though he endeavors to do so, words fail to describe the glory of what he beheld in the resurrected, ascended, and glorified Jesus. And all John could do was fall at His feet as one dead. Then He, that is Jesus, placed His hand on me, John says, and said these words again, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. There's nothing that existed before me that could sneak around up on me that I don't know about. And I'm the last. There's nothing coming in from this direction. You know, I can't be flanked. I've always been. I was before all things. I'll be there when all things are brought to a conclusion. And I'm everywhere in between. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead. And behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the key of death and Hades. I won't fear anything that He's conquered. If He's got the keys to death and Hades, then death, where's your sting? And Hades, where's your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who has given us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Live in victory. If you are subject to the Lord's call, if you want to get your life put right with God and leave fear behind, then we encourage you to come this morning and we'll help you in any way that we can while we stand and while we sing.